You took your shot at the king and you missed. And now you don't even have plausible fucking deniability that you didn't do it. We know you did it. We can see you did it. We can see that you know that we can see you did it. It's over. So now is when they get really dangerous, sadly, because now they got nothing left to lose.
This rip of TFTC was brought to you by River. It's the best place to buy Bitcoin. Go to river.com/TFTC and enjoy this episode.
You've had a dynamic where money's become freer than free.
If you talk about a Fed just gone nuts, all the central banks going nuts.
So it's all acting like safe haven.
I believe that in a world where central bankers are tripping over themselves to devalue their currency, Bitcoin wins. In the world of fiat currencies, Bitcoin is the victor.
I mean, that's part of the bull case for Bitcoin.
If you're not paying attention, you probably should be.
Yeah, is this the low energy podcast that you go on? Is that?
Well, it's not low energy, but you tend to match the energy of the person that you're talking with, right? I mean, you know, so you get a lower energy version of me because you are project calm and rationality as opposed to, you know, allowing me to like go off on, you know, indulge my own, you know, endocrine system. It's a different thing, so.
It is, and I don't know if I'm going to be that calm today because I don't know what is rational, what is up, what is down. It's been a week, and I hit you up, I think, on Monday after the assassination because I think a lot of what's going on between the last time we spoke and now is really an acceleration of a lot of the themes you've been talking about. Obviously, the failed assassination attempt and then the aftermath of that, which is – it seems like Trump's going to win in a landslide. He's picked his VP, and it seems like there is an inter-cabal squabble here in the U.S. that the tech elite are really taking advantage of in the aftermath of the failed assassination attempt.
That's interesting. You know, you talk about that because if you want to start with that angle, which is the whole J.D. Vance, Vivek, Peter Thiel, what I think my friend Pete Canones calls the PayPal mafia. I'm interested in your take on that because I don't really have a take on that yet. I mean, I kind of do, but it's not one of those things that I've given some thought to it. I've been exposed to the arguments. I chatted with Pete privately for about an hour and a half one night, and I'm going to have him on my podcast later next week. And then we're going to go over this, right? I want to hear some more details on what he, you know, seems to know about this. So I don't know. So I'm actually interested in your take on what you think is going on because I think it's interesting. You're probably closer to it than I am.
To me, it just seems like there's been this bubbling movement by the PayPal mafia and others loosely associated with them to wrangle control of the Republican Party, specifically just kicking out the neocons and the Lindsey Grahams and Mitt Romneys of the world and laying the ground for new kids on the block who really want to take America in a different direction. I'm not so sure that it's not neocon light or maybe even just neocon rebranded with techno, with a techno rap in terms of AI surveillance and AI tech in the battlefield. They do seem
maybe
more pro business and more or less willing to play ball with the radical left, if you will. I don't know. I can't tell if it's a good or bad thing, or if it's just the continuation of the uniparty with a different sort of flavor to it moving forward.
It's worth having that skepticism without a doubt. I'm not going to argue in that respect at all. It's in many ways the way I feel about it as well, right? And we were talking about this in my community. We were chatting about this because people can go, deal and I don't know, like it. And so the whole thing started to get out of control, and I just kind of stopped it, and I just drew cold water on it. I said, look, similar to my argument about the Fed, and versus say the ECB or, you know, Davos or whatever you want to call them, the globalists. this is a fight that's bigger than you, me, or any of us commenting on it, right? If you're going to have a fight like this, then if this fight's going to happen, then you have to have somebody in your corner who is, well, powerful enough to actually fight the other side. You have, you know, at a certain level, you have to go to war with the dragon. But you'd rather the dragon on your side, this dragon, than not have a dragon at all, because you can't fight both these dragons, ultimately. And I think that you can make the argument that big tech, Google, Microsoft, you know, that crowd versus old tech, or sorry, little tech, meaning Musk, Thiel, the PayPal mafia. Well, you know, in that fight, if it's a technology world that you're living in and we're not going back to the 1850s, then don't you think we should have somebody in our corner? Even if we have to then turn around and deal with them later. Like, first you got to fight the big fight, and then you can fight a smaller fight after that.
I think I agree with that. And I'm loosely associated with some of those circles in terms of some events I've been to. And I feel like I understand the perspective that they're bringing to this administration and the future of America. And they do, in terms of economics, like, I think they're way stronger on economics, way more willing to unleash American ingenuity and innovation and really let the private sector flourish. And they do want to bring back energy abundance and deregulation and lower taxes. And from like the defense industry perspective, I've heard some of these defense investors talk at some mini conferences I've been to, and they make a very compelling point, which is the military industrial complex that's just living off of these government contracts and sucking godly amounts of money away from the $800 billion annual defense budget, or simply wasting all that money. And the defense tech private industry is basically making the argument we can protect America and do it for a tenth of the cost, potentially even less. And that is something from the fiscal conservative side of my mind makes a lot of sense to me. And if you're giving those two options, I'm like, yeah, the second option seems way better.
Yeah, that's, you know, I can live with that as well. Like, you know, this is an information war we're in, right? And so you're not going to go to war without somebody in the information space on your side. And so, you know, if that's their plan, if that's their perspective, you know, we're going to have to, you know, distrust but verify. I'm okay with being skeptical of them. I'm still really skeptical of people like Ramaswamy and whatnot, but simply because, you know, I'm always skeptical when somebody comes out of the woodwork and is all of a sudden presented to me as the new savior. I don't care who he is. He could be, you know, if I didn't already know him, right, for 8 years previous to that, I would have felt that way about Ron Paul, mm-hmm. right, in yeah. 2008. I happen to have been an 8-year veteran of the libertarian, you know, Mises like sector of the world by that point. So I was like, I was the guy behind the scenes pushing and helping Ron become, you know, one of the people behind the scenes pushing Ron forward and trying to push the zeitgeist. But, you know, had that been, you know, cold, no, I'd have been like, who the fuck is this guy? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And, so that's the way I feel about Milei in Argentina. It's the way I feel about Ramaswamy here in the United States. So I'm happy for them to be wrong about them. I've had like knockdown, drag out arguments with friends of mine over this. And I'm like, I'm sorry, but I'm just going to remain skeptical, and we can agree to disagree, or, you know, you can sober up. That's fine. It's all good. Like, I'm thinking, I'm not going to, I'm done. This conversation is over to me. Like, and I'm happy to be wrong. I don't have to be right about everything.
This episode was presented by River. River is the best, most secure place to buy Bitcoin in the United States. Go to river.com/TFTC, set up an account today. You'll be able to DCA into Bitcoin without paying any fees. You'll be able to give people Bitcoin via River links. You'll be able to send and receive Bitcoin over the Lightning Network. And you'll be able to set limit orders. If you want to buy Bitcoin at a particular price below or above where it is now, you can set orders to buy Bitcoin when it hits that price. Go to river.com/TFTC set up your account today. This rip was also brought to you by our good friends at Unchained. Unchained is building a financial services platform for a Bitcoin standard. They have over 7,000 clients that are securing over 90,000 Bitcoin with 12,000 keys on their platform. Their platform leverages Bitcoin's native multi-sig properties. Their cornerstone product is their Vault product, a 2 of 3 multi-sig Vault, which allows you to hold 2 of 3 keys in a multi-sig quorum. That gives you full control over your Bitcoin. They also have an IRA product, a lending desk, and they're rolling out a bunch of other products, including inheritance protocol and sound advisory. So go to unchained.com, set up a call with their concierge onboarding team today, tell them that TFTC sent you, and use the promo code TFTC at checkout. Unchained.com.
Yeah, and we're sort of jumping forward here. I mean, I think we should definitely touch on what happened last Saturday and how big of a wrench, because it seems like there was a calculated plan to kill this man and then push forward some agenda rather quickly before the election. And then, by God's grace, turned his head, and now we live in a completely different timeline.
Yes, we do. We do. It's funny. It's like we, you know, and it's funny that everybody's talking about it in those terms. It's like, this is the kind of thing that, you know, I just find it funny, Marty. I'm just going to digress for just a little bit and say, you know, I've been reading this kind of fiction my entire life. Like, I started reading Philip K. Dick when I was 12, right? So the whole idea of like multiple timeline fractures, and, you know, that I studied quantum mechanics and college, and like, so, you know, I understand like eigenstates, and like at a very deep level, I've been doing this stuff for a long, long time. So to me, this is like old hat, right? You know, this is like, this is nothing new. I've been talking about forking timelines like for, you know, most of my adult life, as if it's, you know, just another plot point in a failed movie script I never published, right? But now I'm living it. And now I'm watching everybody else reflect it back at me, right? And I think it's, well, aside from the fact, I think it's immensely cool. It's also, I'm glad to see that everybody is, that so many people are hip to the idea that, yeah, this was not the way this was supposed to go. Trump was supposed to be dead. The RNC was supposed to go completely different. And here we are. The guy missed. Trump survived. And it's a different world, but it's a different one than the world they had planned. It's exactly the same world we were in. That's the weird part about this. We were in this world already. Oh, they're going to kill Trump. Oh, they missed? You mean we don't have to lose? But we already lived with all of that dread. We already lived with, okay, so yeah, they were going to like run the table on us, and they were going to replace Trump with Nikki Haley and then bring Hillary out from the grave, and they were going to run the two of them. That's what I said this 6 months ago. I had the feels, honestly, I don't, you know, I wrote about it in the February issue of my newsletter. We ran with the theme of demoralization project, you know, demoralization nation, or, you know, demoralized nation. And that was the theme of my entire lead article. It's in the newsletter every month, is anywhere from 3,000 to 4,000 words, depending on, you know, how verbose I happen to be that week. That's where I came down to as I was writing that article. I'm like, oh, I can see what the biggest demoralization campaign is, to get rid of both Trump and Biden. And then somehow, you know, Biden is easy. You just 25th Amendment him out, or, you know, you create a thing. But how do you get rid of Trump? Obviously, you kill Trump. And we set up a Hillary versus Haley. And I was taking it back then from the argument that, why won't Nikki Haley drop out of the race when she clearly can't win? And why is she staying until Super Tuesday? Well, it's to collect as many delegates as possible to have the imprimatur being able to walk into the RNC with no Trump and say, I'm the heir apparent. And she was, of course, the one that they wanted and everybody had lined up behind, because she was the perfect neocon. Just like Hillary is the perfect neocon for the Democrats. And that was the plan. And that plan's gone. It's trash. And the one prominent figure in all of this who has not tweeted since July 12th is Hillary Clinton. And I think that's the biggest tell of them all.
Do you think this is an attempted uniparty hit? Like, just the the neocons and the Clintons?
I think it was everybody. Mm-hmm. I'm going to be honest. You got the tape of Victoria Nuland hours beforehand smirking. She's saying, oh, you know, Trump's not going to be the nominee. You know, this is my smug face, like Jeremy fucking Clarkson, for Christ's sake. And I was saying previous to, and again, I was saying, I say this, you know, I speak into a microphone a lot, right? I know we both do, but some of it is not all public. Some of it is, a lot of it is behind the paywall. And I had been saying to people, you know, we've been talking about this, and the thing kept coming up over and over and over again, both public commentary and privately. It's like, I don't understand. And just like we don't understand why the debate happened when it did. We don't understand why Trump agreed to it. We don't understand why Biden agreed to it. And it doesn't make any sense until I finally put it all together. And I was actually ashamed that it took me that long to figure it out, which was that they were clearly planning on getting rid of both candidates, and they needed to prove to the world that Biden was a mushroom sporifying the White House, and that they were going to kill Trump. And there was this eerie calm that I saw from everybody of note. I saw it from all the European leaders. They all had this, like, they all had this unearned confidence, you know, in the wake of Chevron and Jarczy and the Trump immunity thing, and like all the Supreme Court cases falling away by the wayside. And then all these other wins that kept getting racked up around the board. And like, how are these people acting so goddamn smug that they're still winning? I'm like, oh, it's clear, because everybody knew. This was the worst kept secret in D.C. and Brussels, as far as I'm concerned. Like, everybody who was anybody fucking knew, because they were all acting like they knew. Now, either they knew directly, or they just, you know, they just knew, because it was just, well, you know, Trump's not going to be the nominee. Don't worry about it. We've got this. And everybody, of course, acted like that. And then we're just like operating the Gantt chart and moving forward. And that's what I think was going on. And I think that was the big tell. And the fact that capital markets wouldn't move, because, you know, there was something else going on there too. So,
yeah. I mean, and then you just look at how it was actually enabled to happen, the lapse of the competence from the Secret Service, the whole situation just stinks to the high heavens. Now, yeah, it makes you wonder, like, if they were successful, like, how successful would the covering up of that lapse be? Would it be? Would they not even care? Or now are they forced to care?
I think that was part of their flowchart. And what I mean by that is that they wanted to kill Trump, and they wanted it to be so fucking sloppy and so obvious. This was an orgy of incompetence that they knew the autists of the internet would figure out quickly that there were at least three shooters. I don't know if you listen to or watch Chris Martinson's presentation that he put together. I'm going to give Chris a lot of credit here. Don't peak oil, but I absolutely agree with him on this one. Just listening. My wife was watching it this morning, and I was just listening to his commentary and then listening to the audio and I'm like, yeah, that tracks. Yeah. No, there were three shooters. Now, I assume that there were at least two, because you never, and an operation this important is not going to be some 20-year-old kid. It's not going to be left to some 20-year-old kid. I'm sorry. I just don't buy it. Like, that's just nonsense. Like, I can buy a grizzled ex-vet, you know, dude, something like that I can buy, right? Iraq veteran, something along those lines, who goes crazy, fine. But some 20-year-old, like, freaking, you know, crazy, you know,
incel
zoomer, like, yeah, some crazy zoomer, like, you know, like, really, like, with no muscle tone, yeah, we can barely, like, lift an AR, give me a freaking break. So I just don't buy it. So I think that, you know, to finish that thought, I think it was part of their flowchart. It was going to be so obvious that they killed Trump, so obvious that they were expecting us to lose our minds, and then they were going to be able to clamp down against the violence, go for gun control, go for the whole nine yards, cancel the election, whatever they had to do. I mean, they either had Hillary versus Haley, or they give us a distasteful election in order to keep the imprimatur up that we're still a democratic society, and that all these evil Republicans and these evil MAGA people who we've been telling you for 4 years are domestic terrorists are running around, you know, looting cities. Like, when's the last time MAGA tarts, looted a city, right? Never. But it doesn't matter, because of course, then there would be, you know, it would be Charlottesville all over again. Oh. Okay. You know, it would be a bunch of plants on both sides creating a fake, you know, creating fake tragedy, fake violence, and then hope for tragedy. And that's their operation. That's their MO. They've been doing it for God knows how long now. And, you know, I'm just over it. And I think we all are. And you took your shot at the king and you missed. And now you don't even have plausible fucking deniability that you didn't do it. We know you did it. We can see you did it. We can see that you know that we can see you did it. It's over. So now is when they get really dangerous, sadly, because now they got nothing left to lose.
Huh.
And there ain't nothing worse than a person with power and guns who doesn't have anything left to lose. And if you think that, you know, and I don't, it's not just the domestic unit party. I'm talking now specifically, you know, international forces, like I would consider Davos, you know, slash the old British remnant and the rest of them. Like their Venn diagram has been, the center of all their different Venn diagrams has been destroy Russia. Mm-hmm. And now that's off the table. And Zelensky knows it. Viktor Orban explained it all to Trump. That both sides, Viktor Orban just came out in a radio interview, or yeah, it was a radio interview, I think, just yesterday. And he said, look, I went around, I spoke to everybody, NATO and Trump. And I told Trump, everybody still thinks they can win. You know, Ukraine thinks they can win. The Russians think they can win. Everybody thinks they can win. And so that means is two things. One, that there's a framework for negotiation because both sides still think they can win. So therefore, there's a potential for negotiation where, you know, neither of them get everything they want and we can actually get, you know, get the war ended. But the second thing is that it probably told Trump, yeah, we absolutely need to end this. Mm-hmm. And so Orban goes to Mar-a-Lago on Friday. Trump is supposed to be sentenced originally on Thursday, the 11th. Orban shows up in Mar-a-Lago on Friday and they try and kill Trump on Sunday. And the RNC is on Monday.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and then today, I mean, people are just hand waving it as a simple bug in some software, but the CrowdStrike debacle that grounded a bunch of flights, messed up a bunch of banks and telecom companies. Like, I don't think that's a coincidence at all, especially when you dig into the background of CrowdStrike and their connections to the World Economic Forum and Davos and their intent to push a digital ID. Like, it seems, and that makes me wonder, like, was that part of the success plan? Like, kill Trump, have all this chaos, and then throw this on on top of it. And
okay, Marty, let's take it one step further. As I pointed out earlier, I just did a show with my friends Crypto Rich and Alex Craner, and I pointed it out earlier in the day to everybody as well. Oh, by the way, today was options expiration, and it was the highest valued July OPEX in history. A lot of people had put a lot of money on particular outcomes in the capital markets, and since 10 o'clock yesterday morning, they have been in free fall to get reset to a particular level. Go look at the woodshedding of silver from 31 down to 29.20. I just checked it while you were talking. Gold, the gold closed below 2,400 today? Nope, 2,466 in the cash market, okay? Are you fucking kidding me? We closed 2 weeks ago at 2,499.95. Are you fucking kidding me? Like, you know, like at the end of the day, like, clearly, markets were reset to a particular level because someone was going to lose a shit ton of fucking money. Mm-hmm. And that happened on OPEX today. Guess what? Monday morning will look completely different.
So, what do you mean? Do you think Bitcoin?
What I mean by that is that we saw 41,000 on the Dow closes last week at 41 grand. It closes this week at 40,288. 287 and change, close enough to 40 grand that, you know, not too many people lost their ass. It's going to go back up to 41 grand next week. Like, yeah, this will be a false move down, as Martin Armstrong would put it. It'll be a market move. All of these were market moves against the trend in the same way that we saw, that I expected on the last day of trading on Q2 to end the month of June. I said, yeah, they're just holding the markets in amber. Monday morning, the markets are going to explode. And yeah, lo and behold, the freaking bond market moved 13 points that Monday. On no news. It just moved. It moved because has been held in place. And when you try and hold markets against the directions they want to go, it's like the classic example of holding a beach ball below water. And you can only hold it down there for so long that eventually, you know, your arms get tired and it explodes. And the deeper you push the market against its will, the worse the higher the beach ball is going to fly when it comes out of the water. It's because you're talking about short positioning. They had positioned, in that case, they had positioned oil so short. The speculators were like 95% net short. It was a historic short position in oil. I'm like, well, that's a clear signal that we've reached the bottom. And then I told everybody to go long oil at like $77 and because it's going to 90. And it did so in like 7 trading days. And it hit a high of like 88.50. It was just a massive short squeeze. And then it held that as well. I mean, it was crazy.
Quick break here, freaks. This rip is brought to you by Gradually Then Suddenly, a framework for understanding Bitcoin as money by Parker Lewis. I wrote the foreword to the book. I'm honored to have done so because it's the best 0-to-1 primer if you're looking for a logical explanation of why Bitcoin obsoletes all other money. Buy one for yourself and maybe a few for your friends. Go to thesafehouse.com/gradually. That's thesafehouse.com, safe spelled SAIF, thesafehouse.com/gradually. Use the promo code TFTC for $5 off at checkout. Buy it now, freaks. The price of Bitcoin is going up. You need to understand it. This is the best 0-to-1 primer. This rip was also brought to you by our good friends at Zaprite. If you're a Bitcoiner and run a business or an independent contractor, you should be accepting Bitcoin as payment. If not you, then who? If we believe that fiat is systemically fragile and is a risk, the rails that currency runs on are a risk as well. You need to begin accepting Bitcoin as soon as possible. Invest in the future of your business. Create a redundant rail by accepting Bitcoin as payment using Zaprite and reduce risk for your business. I've done this for my business. Here at TFTC, we use Zaprite. It allows you to easily create invoices, payment links, or connect e-commerce stores, connect your wallets or custodial accounts, and be set up in minutes. We can also connect our bank accounts, our Stripe accounts, or Square accounts to accept fiat as well. The time is now, freaks. The fiat system is fragile. Invest in the infrastructure that de-risks the future. Invest in yourself. Bitcoin payments with Zaprite. Go to zaprite.com/TFTC to get $40 off their annual subscription. Zaprite.com/TFTC, $40 off.
We're dealing with people who think they can control everything. And clearly they can't control the wind, and clearly they can't control, you know, the heat, and or, you know, depending on your ecclesiastical bent, the will of God, you know. And I'm not, you know, if there's an event of my lifetime, and I will be honest, I'm dead serious when I say this, that, you know, makes me question my renunciation of Catholicism as a child, it's this. I don't know how to explain this. I just don't. Like, Trump turns his head while the bullet's in the air, or while the guy is squeezing the trigger. Dude, I got nothing. You know? Yeah. I got nothing other than the universe was like, no, Trump's not going to die because humanity is not going to wipe itself out. Not part of the plan. Whatever that plan happens to be.
Now, I'll admit I'm a man of faith, and I definitely consider this some form of divine intervention. I mean, just when you look at the videos that have come out of where it would have hit if he didn't turn his head and how it just barely grazed him, it's hard not to believe that this was some God putting his finger on the weight on the scale.
Yeah. No, it's funny. You know, I went to a conference. I spoke at a conference up in Lloydminster, Alberta, 3 hours east of Edmonton, put on by Sean Newman. And I opened up, I had the opening statement for the day, basically, and I had a 15-minute speech. And I wrote about, and in trying to figure out how to frame that talk, I was working out, you know, what to talk about. Because, okay, we're going to talk about the end of the world. Well, because that's what it felt like we were, you know, prepping for, right? And I'm like, and I reminded, as I went back in time, and I was thinking about what to say, I remembered a poem I wrote when I was in, as an undergraduate in college, not a particularly good poem, not one that I was, that I would consider, having as, I have, my poetry is buried deeply on the website. You have to go look for it. If you want to go find it, and those are the ones that I'm technically proud of. And this is not one of them, but it was interesting that this one kept coming back to me. And there's a line in that poem where it said, it was just like, God put his finger on the Empire State Building and spun the world. And the way that, and it's supposed to be, a view of the end of civilization from a bagel shop in Gainesville as communism's falling and all of this stuff. And that, there's this massive collapse of society outside, but, we're all so blissfully ignorant, just, going about our normal routine, who's, doing the crossword puzzle and who's trying to, and what waitress is being nicer than the other one in order to try to get a decent tip and blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, yeah. And in the end, God took his finger off the Empire State Building. And I didn't really, that's how the poem ends. And I thought about it, and I think about where New York is now. God has definitely taken his finger off the Empire State Building because, Wall Street's moving to Miami and New York is rapidly being turned into a museum, or worse, a John Carpenter movie. Right. And, there's my 21-year-old or 22-year-old, 21-year-old cynical self, thinking through that. And what was funny, I said to people in Lloydminster at the time, I was like, when I wrote that, I had nothing but kind of contempt for all these people. And when I read it now, I don't see anything other than pathos. It's a completely different person who watches this now. So it's a weird thing. Just the arc of, when you think about it, how you've gotten to the moment you're in this life, to be standing up on a stage, like recounting. And I wrote, and I read the poem out loud and then the speech, and I'm like, damn, it's been a weird freaking ride. And then here we are, 3 months later, and this thing happens, and wow, I sometimes I just left speechless, to be honest with you.
Oh, that mind, you think it's the best time to be alive, or is it not the most opportune time to be alive?
I don't know. Depends on who you are, I guess. I want to say that I've spent my entire life prepping for this moment, right? But I didn't really, right? We all have wound ourselves up in these, where we are. We're all the sum total of every decision that we've ever made in our lives. And maturity is when you finally take, if you can call it that in my case, trying to take responsibility for every one of those decisions. And you have to, if you want to be an adult and you want to be taken seriously as an adult. But, we're all here now. And then you got to say to yourself, well, was that part of the plan? And then, whose plan was it? Was it yours? Well, you're barely in control of your own behavior on a day-to-day basis. It is what it is. And then you start thinking about it. I've said for a long time now that the universe is far more interesting a place than anything I have to say about it. Mm-hmm. And that's my way out. I get to stand on both. I get to have my foot on both islands, and that's fine, because what I'm trying to do is say, look, I'm willing to submit to the whatever the universe has, in store. So at the end of the day, the best you can do is comport yourself the best way you can, speak truth, do the thing, try and be the best version of yourself you can be every day. Now, do I achieve those goals every day? Oh, fuck no. it's not even close. My spiritual scorecard is not a, it's pretty fucking thin margin, but whatever, you do your best. And the same thing goes for Donald Trump, and the same thing goes for a lot of other people. And this is one of the things that always liked about Trump. I've always felt about Trump. I don't know if I liked it about him, but I felt about him, which is that, you know, Trump knew he wasn't a good guy. Right? I mean, he clearly looks back on that guy that I grew up with in New York. I've known about Donald Trump since I'm 9 years old, for fuck's sake. Right? But Trump looks back on that guy. He's like, I got a lot to atone for or whatever. And he's like, you know, I'm gonna stop putting myself first. I'm gonna put everybody else first. For whatever reason. And now, heaven help his enemies.
That gets a good point. I mean, it seems like it's pretty obvious the shot they missed. They've got nothing left to lose. Like, what is this wounded animal that's being cornered right now do? And what is the next 3 months leading up to the election look like? And then if and when he's elected, where do we go from here? And is there an actual chance to defeat this dragon and get out the other end on better footing?
There is. Of course there is. Like, if you believe that this was the hand of God that, like, you know, spared Trump's life, then you have to believe that. I mean, yeah, I'm not even speaking from that, you know, I'm not even speaking from that position. I'm saying that if you believe that, and a lot of people are, well, then you have to believe that we have the opportunity to slay the dragon, because we've been given the opportunity to slay the dragon, right? So, okay, well, then let's seize the opportunity, but let's not be stupid, you know? It's time to play offense, not defense. And I don't mean go out and, you know, beat people up in the streets for having purple hair and a nose ring and saying terrible things about Trump. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying in the information space, we have to be on offense. We have to not at all in any way give credence to the crazy people on the left who are now working with the intelligence agencies to seed the zeitgeist with malice and disinformation about this event. This was clearly, and I've been doing this a long time, and to me, I've never seen an information space get so polluted so damn quick than I did after that shot missed. Clearly, this was an attempt by multiple agencies. It's going to come out. There are at least three shooters as far as I'm concerned now. And this is partly inductive reasoning, partly it's, you know, I may be wrong, fine, I don't care, doesn't matter. I know what I saw. I know what I've heard. I know what I heard on the day when the first time I listened to it. I'm like, oh, there's at least two people. There's two different guns here. And I'm losing my hearing, but it hasn't gone that far. And I'm like, so it's time for them to prove to us that they're not crazy. They've done nothing to call us crazy about everything for decades. Sorry. You're the crazy people. You get to prove to me that Donald Trump set this thing up with a blood package. You show me the squib. You show me you show it to me. Otherwise, fuck off. They tried to kill a former president and the presumptive president and plunge the country into civil war and execute a coup against the American people. You answer for that and piss off about everything else. And we have to go on that offense and we have to bypass the entire narrative structure that the IC is currently putting in place to pollute the information space and to pollute the zeitgeist. No, it's like the Democrats immediately wanted to go for, oh, Joe's a little senile. Who are we going to replace him with? No. How did we saw this 3 years ago? You knew he's been decompensating for fucking 3 years. You knew we've had a junta, an unelected junta running the country. The president hasn't been the president for 3 years. That's treason.
Mm-hmm.
Can we have that conversation before we decide on who's going to be next? You're trying to shift the Overton windows so goddamn far in your direction that everybody's a whiplash. Fuck off.
Yeah.
This is what we need to do.
And I think another thing, like the nature in which they tried to do it, another thing that's odd about last Saturday is the fact that it was as widely covered by mainstream media as any of his stump speeches have been throughout this campaign. And so they obviously wanted a spectacle. Yep. They wanted They want it that plastered. And that is truly nefarious to the point of like demonic, where they wanted that, that trauma plastered on everybody's TV and on social media over and over and over again.
Yeah, no, I brought that up, that point. I'm glad you brought that up, because I forgot to bring it up earlier. Yeah, it's a very, very important point, and I brought it up at every other public appearance I've made in the last week, which is, oh, by the way, this was the first Trump rally that CNN covered live all fucking year. Yeah. They knew. Or at least someone at CNN knew.
Yeah.
So, I mean, come on. What am I, 12? You know, that I would believe, that would believe this fairy tale, you know?
Yeah. And that's, and it's, what's been very positive the last week is the reaction from most people, particularly people in the center and even leaning more towards the left, who have had this, oh my God, that is even a step too far for me. Obviously, there's been people like Destiny out there who've been putting out just utter despicable commentary on what happened. But, and obviously you have all the people who are commenting, like, I wish the shooter didn't miss. But I do think there's a material amount of people in the center and even trending left who saw that. I mean, gosh, even my father-in-law, who's an MSNBC guy, like, was, he didn't go as far to say that that's a step too far, but even he was like, oh my gosh, this is insane.
Yeah, that's a good, and that's a good thing. I was one of the, Marty, you and I have spoken in a couple of months, but one of the things I was saying leading up to the debate was that I don't wish this on Joe Biden. I have no wish to abuse him in the same way that his wife and family and handlers and, you know, political apparatchiks are abusing him, because the Biden administration is now nothing but more than an organization for elder abuse. But what I said was, coming into the campaign, we need a galvanizing moment. And what better galvanizing moment would there be than for Joe Biden to stroke out on stage and just explain to everybody just how bad things really were. I was expecting them to juice him up like they did at the State of the Union and get his meds wrong. And then he finally just, you know, like, collapse under the pressure, because they can get him to whatever state they want for about 15 minutes with the right drugs. But 90 minutes is like, there's no way. So they didn't. They punted and they went the exact opposite direction, which wound up being its own form of memetic collapse, right? Of, oh my God, Biden's decompensating. We need to replace him. That's okay, because we're going to kill Trump next week. Well, if you do that, they're going to hand the election to Trump. No, we're not. We're going to kill Trump next week, and then we're going to install Nikki Haley. Problem solved. And it was like, the whole thing was staring you right in the face. Once you put it all together, why the debate before the nominating conventions, why this, why this, why that, all these anomalies, why this orgy of anomalies and this orgy of incompetence by the Secret Service and the police department on scene. Like, it just, you know, there comes a point where, you know, I'm sorry, but I choose not to disbelieve. I'm going to roll. And, you know, this is D&D. I choose to disbelieve the illusion. Oh, look, I rolled a natural 20. I don't even need to roll a natural 20. I just got to not roll a 3. Like, you know, it's dumb.
Yeah. And they don't have good poker faces either. I mean, you already mentioned the fact that Hillary has tweeted. Then did you see the picture of Lindsey Graham and Sheldon Adelson in the press box? And they looked completely deflated. Like, like they knew screwed the pooch.
Yeah, like they know. Trump knows that they were in on this. You think, like, these people are all in serious, serious trouble. So, and they don't know what to do now, because if they kill him, they won't have. There will be no excuse that they can come up with that justifies them tamping down the domestic violence that would come their way. Because when it happens this time, oh yeah, the whole thing collapses. Then people start taking pot shots at FBI, and FBI, Secret Service, this one, that one, everybody becomes the whole law enforcement apparatus. It becomes open season to 85 million American gun owners or whatever the hell the number is. Like, that's what's going to happen. And I got news for you. Everybody in power right now is doing that calculus. Do I want to get shot for the next attempt?
Well, I mean, that gets to a good point. Like, do you think they'll do it?
If they have I don't think they have a choice. It's a really good question, Marty. What I'll say then is the following. My modus operandi has been that they're going to allow Trump to win because for months it's been like, well, the best thing, their best play is to let Trump win, but leave him with such a shit show, foreign policy, domestically, and everything else, that he can't actually get anything done. They just poison pill the shit out of him the same way that Obama poison pilled him from November to January November 2015 and January 2016. Well, you just got a whole year to do this. So that was the NATO summit and like all the, and that's why all these 10-year bilateral defense agreements between the EU members and NATO members in Ukraine, remember, they're all been doing it, like all signing individual security guarantees with Ukraine, Poland and Romania and the UK and this one and that one. Why? Because they're trying to set up an Article 5 trigger to ensure that the United States comes in like Rambo without a jockstrap and bails their asses out from another war that they're fighting against the Russians.
Yeah, then you have Blinken come out today and say that Iran's 2 weeks away from having a nuclear
weapon.
Yeah,
oh, of course, of course. Like Iran's been 2 weeks away from a nuclear weapon for the last, you know, I don't know. How old are you?
33. Again?
Okay, I'm 56. They've been saying that since I was 33.
It's the day I was born. And they,
And it seems like you were born. There you go.
Since it seems like Trump is my base case is that they just try to leave him with a complete shit show fiscally on the economic side. They're going to begin to precipitate an economic crisis. And it seems like he's reading that choreography. And obviously I'm not the biggest fan, but I thought the signal that was sent this week of him seriously considering Jamie Dimon for Treasury Secretary is a signal like, I need a wartime Treasury Secretary. Like, if we're going to go into this, I need a seasoned vet who's been through liquidity crisis and banking crisis. And he's sort of arranging his part of the chessboard, thinking that's what they're going to do.
Well, and honestly, I have a really off color story that I just told in my other interview about when I saw that Dimon was being considered for Treasury Secretary. Because you know what I've been saying about Dimon and Powell, that they're the two leading sovereigntists on Wall Street to get this shit and thing turned around, and that they're part of the infrastructure, the foundation for how we could turn the battleship United States away from, you know, these evil globalists. You've got to start with getting control of the monetary system to put Congress into a fiscal crisis, because you can't reform anything until you have a crisis, and you can't reform Congress in Congress. You can't get Congress to vote against themselves. You got to put external pressure on them. Well, how else do you put external pressure on them except by, you know, giving the Fed chair all the tools he needs to raise interest rates to AIDA, right? To, well, in this case, 5.5%, and then hold them there and let everybody squirm. And now we're staring at a fiscal cliff. We're staring at $1.1 trillion worth of debt servicing every year and everything else. Oh, by the way, folks can't run $1.7 trillion deficits anymore. So time to defund the NGOs. Time to get rid of the time for everybody to get serious about real, honest-to-God reform. On the one hand. On the other hand, you have, I think Dimon is part of that. Dimon has been unbelievably clear about what needs to be done. And when I heard that Dimon was going to be the being considered for Treasury Secretary, I called my wife. I was actually in the bathroom I was like, she's like, come over here. She's like, no. Like, that's why I just shouted across the room what was going on. All right, across the house. I'm like, Jamie Dimon is, you know, like how good am I? And so your husband is, brilliant and sucing it and wise and all of these things. I was just, being me, at least in private. And she just screams back, how were you able to sit down on the toilet with balls that big? And I'm like, one at a time, baby. I had to slip them in there one at a time. And she's like, oh, you're hilarious. I didn't miss a beat. I'm like, it's just great. It's just like, and again, I'm not like, it's just, I say that mostly tongue in cheek, right? But I can tell you that of all the things that have been like retweeted at me over the last like 5 days, that has hit my inbox either privately or publicly at least 30 or 40 times. And they're all like, oh my God, dude, how did you call that? I'm like, cause I can read a board. And I was hilarious. And so that tells you Dimon was putting his succession plan together at JP Morgan earlier in the year, right? I noted when I heard that all these VPs would be moved up into presidency positions and blah, 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 blah. And the one name that wasn't involved and I didn't notice in any public discussion of his succession, Dimon's succession plan, was Mary Erdos. Mary Erdos is one of the VPs of, VP I don't remember what division she's in, but I remember talking to a couple of really, really in the know Wall Street vets, and they're like, oh, she's the snake in the garden. She didn't accompany him to Davos this year, or she did accompany him to Davos this year because she didn't want him, and she was on his arm the entire time. Why? Keep your friends close and your enemies closer, because Erdos was the one that actually managed the Epstein account at JP Morgan. So Erdos is gone. She's not part of the succession plan at JP Morgan. Really important little. These are little teeny things that if you don't, and I wouldn't know this stuff on my own. Like I get this stuff sent to me. I'm so grateful to have just put myself in a position. Right. Again, we talk about the position you put yourself in by doing this work, like in the decisions you've made previously, put you in a position to get information that comes to you and you're like, oh, I can work with this. Oh, that makes sense. And, you inspire people themselves to do good work and to, and that's what we're here for. We always wind up talking, you and I always wind up talking about this in a certain way, certain level, which is that, this is really important that, so little of this is about you or me or anything else. It's about what we're hoping to inspire in other people by doing what we do, and then create a room that's smarter than the people who think they're the smartest people in the room, manipulating us and manipulating reality and moving the Overton window where they think it, because they think they control the Overton window, and they don't. We control the Overton window, and that's the big thing.
Yeah, and the best analog to this is like open source software. It's going to outcompete these closed source walled gardens any day of the week. And that's, up until 3 decades ago, like the walled gardens, the closed source software or wargaming was the dominant structure of the day. But now that we have open source software and open source lines of communication and sort of hive minds, there's no way that they can compete. And to your point, like they can't come to grips with that. And they do not want that to happen at all, but it is happening. And that's what
they think they can just run their AI servers at, they just run more AI servers and do bad relational searches and win. And it doesn't work that way because databases are dumb and they can be seeded with bad information.
Somebody wrote a blog post about OpenAI, ChatGPT, and its limits. OpenAI has scraped the entire internet history. It's using that. And the people creating OpenAI don't recognize that most of the content on the internet from the time it was launched is written by people who are not that smart. So,
well, there's not just that. Now, like, if you don't think that the AI wars are not going to devolve down into Philip K. Dick's second variety again and again and again and again and again, I urge everybody to go sit down and reread Second Variety. It's very short, one of Phil's earliest anti-war short stories. You can find it anywhere. You can find it for free online. It's not even hard. And you'll realize that, you know, it's all about the escalatory nature of weaponry and warfare, that, you know, every evolution in war becomes a different, you know, the weapons keep evolving and evolving and evolving. And eventually you get to the point where you have, you know, robots that are indistinguishable from humans and doing infiltration and blah, 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 blah. But the AIs are going to be the same thing. Now you're going to, the next generations of AIs are going to be programmed to seed bad information into the internet to limit the opportunity, to limit the effectiveness of the previous generation AIs. And then so on and so on and so on and so on and so on. And eventually it's all going to just collapse under the weight of its own lack of good information. Because, you know, everything is still GIGO, right? It's always GIGO. Garbage in equals garbage out. And if you know how to, that's what the intelligence agencies do. They think they have a monopoly on seeding bad information into the zeitgeist. I got news for you. Like, there's the autistas on 4chan that are just as good, if not better now. And they understand.
They're better.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. They understand that, they understood a while ago that that's how you win.
I mean, that's how Trump got elected first time around, right? Because he was a 4chan president.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. No, and so I'm at that point now where, you know, yeah, okay, fine. Great. You think you're going to win? Like, we can create bad information faster than you can process it. In the same way that Karl Rove or Dick Cheney, whoever, said, you know, we're in the reality creation business. I know it's attributed to Dick Cheney, but I really do think it was Karl Rove that said it originally, that we're in the we're in the reality creation business, and that you'll be, as we create reality, you'll be forever chasing us to try and figure out what we just created, and then we'll be on to the next reality. Yeah, dude, we're the ones creating the reality now.
Yeah.
And we're ahead of you because we can see you. You know, I said to my partner, Dexter White, the other night, we were texting back and forth. I think it was after Trump got shot. This conversation took place, probably was. And I said, you know, part of the reason why we're so good at this, it's not because we're so freaking good. It's because we've been doing this for so long and the cast hasn't changed. We just know the cast of characters so well. We can predict what they're going to do before they even do it. Like, these people, I mean, you know, what happens when there's a real changing of the guard? And we're not like, we know Mitch McConnell, we know Feinstein, we know this one, we know this one, we know that one. Okay, how does this all work? Well, what happens when it's the next generation? We don't know these people very well. We opened this conversation with my admitted ignorance about the PayPal mafia. So this is exactly the kind of thing I'm talking about. Like, you know, I'm just, you know, I'm part of an older generation of information warriors, for lack of a better term, that, you know, is trading on all of my experience when dealing with these people. But there's all the same people. So it's going to be a very interesting time. And I said to him, I said, there could come a point where, you know, we might actually have to work really hard at this. And he's like, thank God. Because it's not just that we'd be bored. It means that the board has changed so much that that's a good thing. It's a different board than the one we've been living with our entire lives. Like, I've been dreading this moment in the metaphoric sense since I'm 9 years old, dude. Like, since the West Side Highway fell down and in New York City in 1976, I'm like, if we don't have enough money to rebuild the West Side Highway, how in the fuck are we going to do everything else that we want to do? Like, what's there going to be for me when I'm 25? I was sitting in the back of my parents' 1976 Newport thinking this exact thing on my way to my grandparents' house as we were doing the holiday thing where we went all around New York City from my father's family in Brooklyn and Manhattan over to my mom's family in Queens. And, like, I distinctly remember this. I was, like, 9 or 11 years old thinking this and, like, you know, as we were, you know, taking the Bruck, I can see the sign to get on the Bruckner Expressway on the way over to in my head. And it's like one of the few moments I have from that era of my life that I can call that image up at a moment's notice. And you know, it's again shaped who I am and shaped where we're going and what we're doing. So,
yeah. So is this week a big white pill in your mind? I think. Preparing for a moment that turned out to go a different direction.
Oof. Yeah, in a way, I think so, because I think it red pilled, for to extend the metaphor, a lot of people who didn't want to be. You know, things were just still comfortable enough. You know that I coined the phrase, you know, comfortable wolves last year, in a moment of frustration with people who are so black pilled that they just think that, you know, humanity is unsavable. And I'm like, bullshit. People are comfortable. When they're comfortable, they don't move. But the minute they're not comfortable, that's when the fangs come out. That's when real change is possible. And I don't see people as sheep. I see them as wolves. And I always have. And I've always hated that phrase sheeple, for example. I'm like, really? We're going to condescend and insult the very people we're trying to, you know, inspire to like go out and fight, you know, fight the bad guys, and we're going to call them shit, and then we're going to motivate them by what? Abusing them? That's a great motivational technique. You fail at your basic Andrew Carnegie, last I checked.
And as you're saying this, I mean, it's not really completely related to this, but maybe, but we haven't even touched on what else has happened between our last conversation and this conversation, which is everything that happened in the UK and France with their elections. And it seems like they were basically setting up this domino effect where, all right, we're going to get in the radical left in the UK and France, and then we'll take care of Trump. And like, when you talk about the global chessboard, like, it's like, oh fuck, the in this whole effect, it just got ripped away from us.
What I will say about that is the following, and Caitlin Long, you know, reached out to me. She's like, dude, we really need to do a podcast. I need to understand what's going on in Europe. And I'm like, okay, no problem. Europe didn't go hard left in France and in the UK. They went globalist. It just happened to be that they needed to get rid of the globalists on the right in order to give you fake change on the left. Now, in France, they got an even worse result than they were hoping for, because they got Jean-Luc Mélenchon, who's probably more of a sovereigntist than Marine Le Pen is. He just happens to be a sovereigntist from the extreme old left. Okay. What they were hoping for was, you know, that when Macron would wind up in the dominant position to form the government, right? And he's not. And that's actually maybe the worst possible outcome for France in a variety of different ways. In the UK, it was a foregone conclusion that, you know, the Tories under Boris Johnson and Rishi Sunak were purposefully destroying themselves to pave the way for Keir Starmer and Labour to take over in the, you know, the least enthusiastic, major, you know, super majority in British political history. I mean, you know, Starmer got fewer votes than any, you know, recent anybody in recent, you know, recent prime minister in politics, because the board was so fractured, right? And it had to be done at that moment. So they had to reaffirm Davos's control over Britain. They had to reaffirm Davos's control over France. And then they were going to push, which they did, push Ursula von der Leyen through again in the EU, kill Trump, and then bring the United States in for the big win on how they were going to, you know, destroy Ukraine or destroy Russia on behalf of Ukraine. And safe to say that that's not part of the plan anymore. And they didn't have enough sense to let von der Leyen go by the wayside and let her they couldn't let go of her as an asset, which was dumb, because, you know, when the European Court of Justice the day before the vote, you know, comes out and says, oh, this woman is a criminal and needs to go to jail effectively, like, who do you think allowed that to occur? What does that tell you? Because the European Court of Justice is a rubber stamp agency for the bureaucrats in Brussels. And for them to come out against von der Leyen the day before her coronation, that was a big deal. I don't know who's, I don't know what knives, who, you know, whose knives got sharpened enough to get that thing through and what that means. But I can tell you, it's nothing good for her. And then she only wins by 41 votes. How much political capital did she have to expend to get those 20 people to vote for her? Because it's all it took. I mean, she only won by 41 votes. 401 votes were in the majority of 360.
What was the crime that the European court?
Oh, it was about buying 10 Pfizer and Moderna shots for every man, woman, and child in all of Europe. And that's so they forced open that all of the contracting, everything unredacted and incomplete, has to be, you know, for all the contract. And she was in charge of all of it. And her, you know, her husband works for a German company that's a subsidiary of Pfizer.
Yeah,
she made a lot of money off of the clot shot.
Yeah, which is another thing. Like, do we have a path towards justice for that now? I mean, obviously, one of the big clips going around Twitter this week was Trump calling RFK. That was leaked, but I'm happy it was leaked. Like, I think this is an Overton window that needs to be opened up and widened, and the discussion needs to be laid bare. I mean.
Yep.
I don't think they were talking in the context of the COVID shots particularly, but I think it could be lumped into a broader discussion about Big Pharma, its influence, and the products that it's putting on the market.
Yeah. What I'll say is the following. Let's go through the whole thing. I was, you know, I lobbied hard for Tulsi Gabbard to be his running mate. I'm not going to make any bones about it because clearly I think in hindsight, J.D. Vance is an excellent choice from a strategic perspective. I was thinking probably a little too tactically. And the same thing goes with RFK. I noted a while ago that after RFK visited Mar-a-Lago, that he went really hard left, making himself really unappealing to a lot of, you know, right-wing libertarians. Fine. That's good. You know why? Because that's actually RFK strategically splitting Biden's hardcore base. And this is important because you don't run to the center of Biden if you're RFK and you're trying to spoil the race for Biden. You want to, that's spoiling the race for Trump. So RFK going harder, hard, almost crazy Looney Tunes left makes perfect sense strategically, which is to try and undermine Biden's hardcore base in all the swing states in order to ensure that Trump wins the election. For that, RFK is probably going to be attorney general or, you know, something along those lines and go after everybody over COVID-19. I think that's what's going to happen because Trump is weak on the vaccine. It is a massive, massive black mark on his record in hindsight. But he gains all that political capital back if he puts RFK Jr. in charge of the Justice Department as Attorney General and goes after Pfizer. In the same way that he's going to probably put, I would lobby now, I think he should put Tulsi Gabbard in as something like Assistant Secretary of State. Mm-hmm. Not Secretary of State, but Assistant Secretary of State. Give her a couple of years at the, you know, in what should have been Victoria Nuland's job, overseeing NATO, overseeing Russia and everything else. And if that's too much, fine. Veterans Affairs or something along those lines. Get her into the administration somewhere where she can get her feet wet, prove to everybody that she is who she is and blah, 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 and do good work, which is all she really wants anyway, and go from there. I think that that's a, if you're talking about a unity cabinet, Trump is going to have to pull from Democrats who, or, you know, from people who are nominally Democrats, who are just trying to do good work and just want to save the country. And he can really, really, you know, put a down payment on that argument. and what he talked about last night in the speech. I think that would be the smart move for him politically and strategically. And those people are, you know, those people are then in prominent positions. And then we know exactly where we stand. And that's fine.
I mean, personally, I would love for Tulsi to have a position. I think her experience being a veteran and also being anti-war and anti-intervention is a much needed voice within any administration. And
yeah, absolutely. And she's turned herself into, and my most recent article about her, I said, I don't see her as a natural public speaker. She's someone who has really had to work very, very hard to become a decent public speaker. But I, you know, dude, I listened to her book. Like, you know, she is who she says she is. And she has always been this person. And, you know, I think she's got a very bright future ahead of her as someone to help, you know, to lead this thing forward. But Trump's going to need some good hardcore Gen X, some good hardcore Gen X badasses, you know, with a chip on their shoulder in very important positions. Like, we can't just skip over the Gen X and give everything to the millennials. We can't do that. You know, he has to put some hardcore, you know, some, you know, hard pipe hitting, you know, Gen Xers, to quote Marcellus Wallace from Pulp Fiction, which seems to keep coming up everywhere today, to get in there and do some hard work. And maybe that's what the PayPal mafia is. I mean, that's where, you know, people like, you know, Thiel and Musk and others are going to exert their influence. But, you know, we'll see what his coat. We'll see. I don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves, but if we get to the November and, you know, the summer violence, which I expected, is going to continue. It's not going to get any easier. You know, there's going to be more attempts at cyber fuckery, you know, bird flu. Like, they're going to throw everything at us, right? Between now and November, there's going to be an October surprise of some form or another after LIBOR ends in September 30th. Like, there's going to be dislocations, and they're going to try everything imaginable to, you know, boomerang any financial unrest in Europe back on the United States and force Powell into a very difficult situation.
Well, that was another encouraging thing this week. If we're, yep, you know, we're aligned with your thesis, which I think I have very much come around to, which is like Trump went to Powell, was like, you're good through your term. You're good through 2028.
Well, he was good. I mean, Powell, I mean, honestly, to be remembered, everybody, is that once Powell is confirmed by the Senate, there's not much the president can do other than change other than revoke the Fed's charter. Mm-hmm. Like, that's, I mean, he's been confirmed by the Senate. He can't be recalled. But the president can't recall the Fed chair. So Powell was, it was Trump's public affirmation of Powell when he had been critical of him previously. And people kept asking me, like, well, I don't know about Trump and Powell and blah, 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 blah. Like, yeah, Trump says a lot of things. Let's see what happens when he's actually the nominee.
Yeah.
Like, what Trump was doing was telling Powell, don't pivot. Don't give Joe Biden a way out. That's Trump's way of saying those things publicly. I don't know about this Powell guy. Like, you know what I mean? Like, he could, like, you know, that's just the way Trump operates. And you got to remember that this is how he rolls. So it was very good for him to say that, along with, you know, the news about Diamond potentially being Treasury Secretary and yada, yada, yada. Like, you know, you brought up a really good point about having someone who's been through the real wars of how to deal with, you know, financial crises in as Treasury Secretary, and not one of these, you know, these academics who will freeze and panic like Bernanke and Yellen, or Bernanke who froze, and Yellen who's always been a freaking commie. So, mm-hmm, right. Yeah. But Bernanke literally froze. Like, when you read Daniel DiMartino Boot's book, it's pretty clear that her picture of Bernanke while she was at the Fed was that, you know, he was out of his depth.
Oh yeah.
He did not know what was going on.
So, that's what, I don't know if you ever read this, but I'll send you a link. My good friend Parker Lewis, Bitcoiner, mm-hmm, he wrote a paper called Ender's Game. And he basically went and dissected the Fed minutes that were released 12 years after the fact, or maybe 10 years after the fact, and just meticulously went through and basically highlighted everything Bernanke said from 2005 through 2012 and juxtaposed it to what actually happened. He was completely wrong about everything.
And that what Bernanke was said, just Bernanke was just terrible. He was not capable of handling. It's almost like, oh, look, we put the most unqualified man imaginable in charge of the Fed at the exact moment when we're going to like destroy the dollar reserve standard.
I know we're coming up on time here, but maybe we should touch on it, which is the rumors that, I mean, that's going back to last Saturday. And as a Bitcoiner, thinking about what would have happened if the assassination attempt was successful, I think Bitcoin would have tanked, wasn't successful. Bitcoin's pumping. We're at 67,000 right now, up 15% this week. And now you have rumors circling that next week at the Bitcoin conference, which Trump will be speaking at on Saturday afternoon, that is he or somebody else is going to make an announcement that Bitcoin will be viewed as a strategic treasury asset under his administration. And it is pretty insane to think that we're at this point where this is even being floated and taken seriously.
Oh God. I just want to shout out to one of my patrons here who first put the idea in my head that this was exactly where they were headed, and that Tether and Bitcoin were, he was doing some plumbing analysis on the markets about 2 years ago. He said this to me. He said, he posted up his work and everything on our private server and chat server. And he's like, I think Bitcoin and Tether are being used to undergird the SOFR and SOFR markets, the repo markets at this point. They're being used as collateral. And he was the first person to put it in my head. And then I started seeing other people talking about it. I you know, threw it out there to see if I can get any, you know, I threw the chum out there to see if I could get any, you know, bites back, right? To see if some sharks would, you know, chum the water. And here we are. And it's become more and more obvious to me that Tether was the stable coin that was not executed to remain as the antipode and the liquidity agent for Bitcoin, to allow for Bitcoin price discovery and the trade in markets and on exchanges that are approved by federal government. Bitcoin is now a strategic asset the same way that gold is. We need collateral. We need hard collateral. You need opportunity cost based collateral in the system. And Bitcoin is a proxy for energy, tokenized energy, in the same way that oil is tokenized energy, right? Oil futures are tokenized energy. So very, very important. And, you know, this was a big deal under Trump in some ways as well. That I remember having long discussions early on in Gold, Goats, and Guns with Dexter White behind the scenes about how we can see the United States becoming a leader in Bitcoin mining. And it was, we did this, we spitballed that during the Trump, during the first season of the Trump show. And we were right, I think. And if he announces that, that would be hilarious and cool and awesome and all those things. And again, I don't care about being right, Marty. It's not about, none of this is about me. This is like, but all this stuff keeps happening because if you can read the board and you understand the people, right? And you understand the incentives, then you can make roughly good, you can throw big darts at the board and you're going to be near the bullseye. You're not going to be 100% near the bullseye on target, but
I think you're on it. I don't think you're near it.
Maybe. And if I am, I am, like, whatever. This business is easy. You can be right 1,000 times in a row and then you can be wrong catastrophically once and you're done. You know, I mean, That's the tightrope you walk when you're in that position, and so you have to, so understanding that, you have to, you know, remind everyone that these are ideas, they're hypotheses that you throw out there, and then you discuss them, and you error check them, and you counterbalance them, and you try to balance your deductive and inductive reasoning in order to come, to conclusions that, could be correct. And then if they do happen, well, then the thing is that, yeah, every once in a while you say something in private, like I said, about me and my wife and the bathroom earlier. Like I don't care. The market humbles you every day. Geopolitics humbles you every freaking day. There's so much to learn. There's so much that you don't know that we all just have a pretense of knowledge. And some of us have a pretense of knowledge in a particular subset of areas that work. But when I sit and chat with you about, we even bring up like the shit you've already brought up in Bitcoin tonight, I hadn't even thought about. I hadn't even considered, what would Trump do in terms of it being a strategic asset? The minute you said it, I'm like, of course he would do that. And you know what I mean? Like, so, these are always valuable for me as they are as much as anything else. I'm not, I love doing these things because it's the only way I'm learning anything, frankly. There are so many smart, connected people who are subject matter experts and things that I am not one. That I got to learn. And we just got to keep doing that every day. And eventually, we'll get close to some version of something that looks like the truth. And we'll go from there.
We've got the volunteer fire department alarm going off behind me. So
I can hear it. Yeah, I can hear it.
It should abate in a few seconds, but it is surreal to see it all come together in this way where Bitcoiners been talking about this asset as a strategic asset and a part of the geopolitical game theory. And it seems, and again, going back to earlier this week, I was like, who do I need to talk to about this Trump thing? It was like Uncle Tom, because it is going back to what we said in the beginning of the episode, like this timeline that we've been thrust on is completely different than the one they wanted us on. And now it seems like the conditions to bring about the world that I certainly want to see, and I think that you want to see, have really improved massively in our favor due to that horrible, thank God, that failed assassination attempt. But it's horrible that it got to that point. But again, like you said, they came at the king, they missed, and now the world is our oyster. And I think really taking advantage of this opportunity that we've been given is imperative, and we cannot, this is the worst time to get complacent and to not get on the offensive and take the ground that we need.
No, thank you for saying that. That's so very freaking important. Like, we're so used to playing defense that it's just like, look, dude, we got the ball and we're on the 25 yard line. All we got to do is we got first and 10 and the refs are in our pockets. Like, you can hold up in the front line. We can do this. I can come up with bad football metaphors all day long. Where's Bill Parcells and three yards in a cloud of dust. And we'll go 25 yards and take 18 minutes to do it. You know what I mean? And how are we going to take, how can we take 18 minutes off the clock and only go 25 yards and score a touchdown? In the early versions of his Giants, we went back to the 40-yard line first and then went forward. I then watched every one of those freaking games and bit my nails the entire time. But, we really do have a great kind of weight has been lifted in some ways. Like somebody mentioned earlier that like a near-death experience is one of those things that changes the way you view the world and the way you view yourself and everything else. And some study, I was listening to somebody talk about this and they become liberating. They don't make you scared. They make you liberated. Like, and it's the hero's journey. So it's the Campbellian hero's journey. The hero has to face their own death before they can confront the villain, like before they can effectively confront their shadow, Jungian shadow in that respect. It's very important. We do that. And I think we all stared at that the other day. And some of us just stared at it beforehand. But
Important to mention, like Trump literally had a near-death experience as an individual, but I think America had a near-death experience. Like the America that used to exist and that we're fighting for would have been completely gone. Shot in the head, like proverbially. Yes, wasn't just that individual.
They would have metaphorically have executed the myth of America. And I've been saying for a long time that they have to do that. This is about, you know, it's at a big idea level, right? It's always been the private versus public formation of capital in the banking, you know, within the banking system, and then government by the people for the people, where individual sovereignty or collectivism, in a sense, are people. You know, the America is that one example that stands out that has to fail, because this way it validates all of their shitty collectivist ideas. You know, well, look, see, it didn't work. It didn't work. Think about, you know, I was thinking about this last month when I wrote the newsletter last month, and, you know, I was talking about aftermath of World War I and World War II and then potentially World War III, how gold was used as a means by which to punish Germany to pay outsized reparations for World Wars I and World War II. Okay. Bretton Woods did the exact same thing they did after World War II, they did after World War I, where they returned the dollar to the pre-war conversion rate, where, you know, even though our debts were, even though the number of dollars in existence did not justify this, gold should have been $200 an ounce, right? And that's clearly what they want to do to Russia post this environment, hold the price of gold down well below its real plate, its real rate, in order to institute reparations on Russia and drain it of all of its vitality by forcing reparations onto Ukraine. That's what they were going to do. And they wanted to make Russia pay at, you know, real rates for gold while issuing shitty currency at, you know, while paying for all of Russia's assets at 10 cents on the dollar. It's a classic colonialist play. And you think about that and you're like, oh yeah, well that's, you know, they needed to destroy. So they blame the gold standard both times. This is the point. Mm-hmm. They blame the gold standard both times as to why everything went bad, when it wasn't the gold standard that was the fucking problem. It was the price at which they priced it. It was the fixing the price of gold to their shitty currency and overvaluing the crappy currency relative to gold. That's what created the problem. They did it on purpose. Churchill knew exactly what he was doing in 1925, and Keynes and company knew exactly what they're doing at Bretton Woods in 1946. And they knew exactly what they were intending to do in 2025 or 2026 when they finally defeated Russia and Ukraine. Okay, so they understand what the gig is, and the same thing goes for Bitcoin as goes for gold. Okay, you know, you keep hard collateralizable assets at well below their clearing rate, and, you know, then use that overvaluation to your advantage to steal real assets. And then at the same time demonize the very thing that you're trying to accumulate, because they bought it. They got all the fucking gold when they did all this shit.
Mm-hmm.
And so they metaphorically, they want to do the same thing to the ideas that undergird the Constitution of the United States. Britain has never, ever fucking accepted the American Revolution. They have not accepted the terms of the surrender, period. They still want their colonies back. Fuck them. They can't have them. And everybody needs to have that spirit in their freaking hearts, guiding them forward, because they just tried to fucking kill Trump. Fuck you. No, you don't get my country.
Yeah.
Period.
Yeah. I think, luckily for us, a lot of people have this mentality now. They may not be focused on the UK specifically, but there's some broad base fire in everybody's belly that they intuitively understand that.
I've been studying long enough. I know that it's like, they're still angry about this. And it's not, and France isn't happy either. And all the rest of them, that's fine. But, you know, in particular Britain, and they need to be, and you know, and they need to be, they need to be called out for it. Like MI6 created, and Hillary Clinton created 90% of what the Democrats today who believe, the 34% of Democrats today that believe that Trump staged his own assassination attempt are the people who were gaslit by Hillary Clinton and Christopher Steele in MI6. Okay. It's that simple. Like, it doesn't have to be a more complicated story than that. MI6 wants Russia destroyed, and they're willing to do anything to do that, to get through that, to make that happen, including help assist the zeitgeist to create a coup against their former colony.
Yeah.
And install, because at the end of the day, Nikki Haley and Hillary Clinton, that's a British presidency. That's a British remnant presidency. That's an old neoconservative British, indistinguishable from British foreign policy, going back to the Milner Group and all that stuff. That's indistinguishable from Cecil Rhodes and the Milner Group, and Churchill grew out of all that, and nothing has changed. Somehow we wound up with Britain's foreign policy.
Well, now something massive has changed where they fucking missed. It is crazy. Yeah,
I fucking missed, dude.
And like, I didn't get to get it in earlier, but like, think about, like, you just gave the double birds. Think about what the double bird to this globalist agenda it would be if he put Tulsi, RFK, other centrist based people in positions of power, and they just went forward and were like, all right, we're dismantling all this. Fuck you. Yeah. We're not out of the woods yet, but you can definitely see the light at the on the horizon.
You can. And you know, it's a light that I saw a path to get us to 3 years ago. And it was a feeling. I feel like whenever I flash back to that moment right after Powell raised the reverse repo rate 5 basis points, and I started to look at what happened, and I said, and I had that moment like Inspector Finch at the end of V for Vendetta, and he goes like through the whole story, and he goes, mm-hmm. I don't know, it was just a feeling. And that's exactly the way I feel. Like every time I think about that moment, I was like, that's exactly the image that comes into my head. And I'm like, oh, there's no fucking way that I'm right about this. Like there's no way I'm right about this. Like, fuck off with that. You're just insane. Like, I said that to myself, and I said that to myself for literally a year and a half. I'm like, y'all need to ever check me on this. I have to be nuts.
And here we are today. Getting less nuts by the day.
Yeah. Marty, I'm exhausted, to be honest with you. I'm gonna have to run, dude. So
yeah, I do as well. My the boys just hopped out of the shower after coming back from the beach, so I should go be a good dad.
Yeah. It's been a lovely chat, and I'm really glad you reached out to me, and I wouldn't have missed this for the world. As always. But I've been talking to a microphone now literally straight for 5 hours, and I've gotta go. I need a cigar.
Go have a cigar. Enjoy your weekend, and I'm sure we'll do it again at some point soon.
Absolutely, we will. And you know, one of these days I should probably have you on my show just to extend the offer. I don't know if you do guest appearances.
I would love to. I would be honored.
Okay.
Love to is an understatement.
Absolutely, dude. We'll just send a thing and we'll schedule something for next month.
All right.
Gladly.
I can't wait.
Okay.
Talk Peace and soon. Love, freaks.